Going to continue now with agenda paper 2C. 2B, just to remind you, of course, is here because it puts into words all of the decisions we've been talking about before, so you can see it. But that is subject to your editorial comments, review, and of course any of the changes that we're making in this process as well. So we're not taking detailed drafting points, but if the way we've expressed something in paper 2B doesn't actually meet your approval, then this is a good time to raise it. 2C, Lucy.
Thank you. This paper pivots around the Mineco example, which is set out in Appendix A. Very simple example, and obviously things are a lot more complicated out there in practice. It's just to illustrate a point. The paper analyzes the effect of adopting the proposed approach of the interpretation on an entity that either uses the strip ratio approach or an approach such as that under US GAAP. Drawing from this analysis then, the staff make a recommendation about the transition provisions in the draft interpretation. And we have recommended some wording, such as in paragraph 22, in paper 2C, as follows. An entity should apply the draft interpretations prospectively to production stripping costs incurred on or after a certain date. And then an entity shall use the existing carrying amounts of tangible or intangible assets as opening balances at that date. Now, in paper 2B, which is the actual interpretation, we do expand on this a little in the transition paragraph 23. So I guess the first question would be, does the committee agree that the proposed approach should be applied prospectively to production stripping costs from the effective date of the interpretation?
Lucy, for clarification here, because we sometimes use prospectively in a variety of different ways. By prospectively, you mean that whatever was pre-existing, even if that was nothing. So if somebody had expensed all the deferred stripping costs but now feels under the standard that they have to start, then they would only start accumulating costs for the first annual period beginning on or after, the suggestion is 3 months after the date of publication. And if they had capitalized something which didn't meet the requirements of this, that they would retain that in their financial statements, but then allocate it aggressively over whatever reserves it was meant to benefit.
Yes, which is kind of question two there as well, that, you know, whether you would not restate opening balances when you...
The perspective is...
Moving forward.
Whatever was there before stays there, and you change going forward. Okay. Laurence?
Yes, in paper 2C, you addressed possibly those cases where there was an asset balance. My question is, what about those cases where there was a liability balance? How do you, what is contemplated under prospective application in case of a liability balance? I wasn't sure.
I don't believe that it's commonly done, creating a liability balance with a strip ratio approach. From the outreach that we've done, it may be, but I don't know how many entities have such a thing.
I think Lucy, there may be one or two outliers who've used life of mine strip ratios and have not limited to zero and dug down into their smoothing mechanism gives them a liability. So perhaps, I mean, we were focusing on, we're dealing with recognition of an asset. Often the valuation of an asset is a debit, not a credit. So in this particular case, perhaps we should just be clear that if there is a credit balance, that that's treated as zero. That is, it's not an asset, so that goes. Scott?
I was just going to comment a little. When this discussion came up in the U.S. 5 years ago, or however many years, it was clear that there were a good number of companies that did not limit themselves to zero on the stripping ratio and would indeed book a liability if that's what applying the ratio did. So perhaps only the U.S. companies were doing that and they're not doing it anymore. I don't know, but it certainly seemed common in the U.S. that there could be a liability.
All right. Jana?
I think I'm answering the question you're actually answering because you linked it to the perspective. And I agree with the perspective, but I am concerned about the comment about whether if there is that basically what is left, so if you like there was an asset, it should be amortized over the specific ore quantity to which the stripping activity related, because some of the asset that is there, if the strip mine ratio has been used, will actually be a development asset as opposed to, and so actually writing that straight off to P&L, I'm not convinced is the right answer, because they should be allowed to still carry that, but amortize it over the life of the mine, as opposed to over the stripping activity, I would have thought, if that's what it is. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that there will always be those situations, but there may well be if they've used that ratio. I think we've just got to be careful of the implications of what we are saying. That it basically it was capitalized and that it is, they thought it was an asset, therefore I can't see why it would need to be written off straight away.
Joanna, what you're describing sounds like development costs, so pre-production. So we would be able to avoid that issue that you described because the scope of the interpretation is just going to be on production stripping.
Okay, but transition bits are talking about, okay, to me it wouldn't be clear. Okay. From reading this transition that you've got to separate the asset that you've got already mm-hmm. between your development bet and the, I agree with you if you follow that logic, but you've got to first say, okay, I've got this asset that I've called one amalgam of thing, and I've got to split it first to then say that the interpretation then applies to this bet,
right.
And I've got to do this with it.
I think
we've got to be careful about what that asset is, because the implication is that the written off to P&L immediately is almost an impairment type question, and therefore it shouldn't have been an asset in the first place.
Yeah, the issue really is something perhaps we need to alert people to, that if they haven't identified their development costs separately, then they are going to have to write them all off. Because if you haven't identified as part of development, pre-production, and know what those costs are, then I don't think there's a basis for saying you can continue to write them off over a long period if you don't actually know what they are. The problem, I agree, of the life of mine strip ratio is that the allocation of those costs is done on some sort of overall smoothing basis, as opposed to calculating what the units of production depreciation would have been of the development costs. But I would be very wary of making any suggestion to say that you can go back and recalculate some things unless we're going to require recalculation of everything else. This is an approach to simplify, to go forward, to say that if you've accumulated these costs and you've been using an arbitrary smoothing method, life of mine before, then you could well end up in trouble. Mm. In the US, when they are soon to make the change to IFRS, they won't have this problem because they've been expensing everything, so that's fairly easy. In Canada, which is about to go, which has its own standard that deals with this, they will have already prepared and identified themselves. So this is an issue for existing IFRS adopters that have also chosen to, or believe that they can capitalize the costs under IFRS and use some sort of ratio method of calculating that, if they haven't distinguished between development costs from subsequent CapEx costs, then they could have a problem. This is designed to say that if you don't know what the costs are, the consequence generally is going to be that they're going to be an expense. In the case of development costs, which are for the life of mine and subsequent stripping, so it only happens there, they should be able to identify from the stripping campaign definition what it was they were trying to exploit and gain access to for those subsequent costs. So at the very worst, they would still have a period over which to write them off. If they can't identify that they relate to anything else, and they've just been mushing everything together, then I agree the consequence is that they've got a hit to profit and loss when it starts. Can we just take some comments from others, though, please? Tuck?
Yes, what I wanted to say was almost explained by Bob. And I think there is some consequence and there is some impact to for those who have adopted stripping ratio method. But I think the situation is limited because if you have identified ore and then it has already been digged out, but then you have to change it into this interpretation. In that case, there is an impact, but normally they have some ore remains. Then you can identify at that time. So then the impact would be that significant. So I agree with the staff's recommendation that we can put it into the profit or loss and avoid prospective, retrospective correction. With respective correction, we should avoid all the retrospective correction. Prospective is better.
Thank you. Luca?
I agree with the staff recommendation to go on the prospective approach. I would like only to suggest that in the basis for conclusion will be included some elements of additional guidance, I would say, or something more explicit, because my only concern is that if you are exactly in the middle, so you have made something similar to the interpretation, so you have identified a campaign, you have made 50% of this, and 50% is one way, and then you have to go to another street, and what you have to do is needs probably more wording, but I fully agree with the idea to go on this path.
I think I'm going to suggest to Lucy that she does add something in the basis which describes the alternatives that we had thought of, including these problem areas, and then came to the conclusion that prospective, if that's what we agree, is the way forward. Jean-Louis?
Yes, I have the same type of concern as expressed in the paragraph 13 of 2C, because if we have already a mechanism to create an asset, but to have to amortize it over the life of the mine, I do not understand whether you will carry on using the stripping ratio method, or do you change it? So it seems to me that the paragraph 13 is saying the contrary, but maybe I'm wrong in the paper.
The intention is that if you've accumulated on a life of mine stripping ratio, you wouldn't need to adjust that balance, but that balance would then be amortized over a specific quantity of ore to which that past activity has related.
Or at least make sure we get it right in the draft interpretation. Ruth?
I support the staff's recommendation. I don't think companies will have an issue with the development versus production phase. I think they should be able to figure that out for themselves. We could put something in the basis. When I read the paper 2C, I was concerned that if we allowed a mixing of the two methods, we might have the wrong amount expensed in total, because we'd have some period using the stripping ratio and some period using the new method. But I think what you've said here will avoid that, because you're only dealing with the asset that's left. You're not forcing them to go back and change anything. So I think it's okay.
All right. then can I just confirm, is there anybody who objects to the staff recommendation? You just want to talk, Guido. You don't want to object.
That's a question. Normally what we say is the best thing to do is obviously retrospective application, and then we give relief if we think it's too hard to do that. Now, if I understand the proposal correctly, we still have to go back in the past and identify the stripping campaigns, the different stripping campaigns, identify the part of the asset that we still have on the books, if we have an asset on the books, under the old mining lifetime stripping ratio approach, and then amortize the different parts of the asset in accordance with the stripping campaigns that we have identified in the past. Now, if we do that, we can also ask them to retrospectively apply. I don't see that this is really a relief, but maybe I'm wrong.
I think we're trying to approach it a little simpler than that, and so the example I'm going to give you is a simplified one. It doesn't work in all circumstances. But on the assumption that a stripping campaign is a concentrated period of activity to gain access to part of the overburden, the economic logic, the business logic is you only spend, and this is what our geologist friend was telling us before, you only spend the least amount of money that you have to spend in order to gain access to what it is you want to gain access to, but bearing in mind that you might want to push back a little bit more later. So you're not going to develop a whole wide pit at the top just to start accessing a small part of the ore. So there is a discrete phase. It's the stripping campaigns would typically have an interval which could be several years between each campaign. So our presumption, I think, is that it is possible to identify, if you want, the most recent campaign or the most recent completed campaign to obviate the problem that Luca was talking about, and then say, so that was a campaign. That will be documented. That will exist in the organization. It's not a question of judgment. It's a question of fact that there would have been a decision, usually at the executive or at the board of directors level, to confirm that capital expenditure decision. So that would have taken place. It's then, don't look at the asset and find bits of it. Look at the asset that's on the books. And then that's what you're going to start now to amortize going forward. So it is a simplification to avoid the burdensome, or in fact I think it's an impracticable objective of trying to go back and recalculate, because the judgments that need to be made to operate the units of production method are estimates at a point in time about what you expect in the future. And if you weren't making those estimates because you were using a life of mine strip ratio, then I don't think you could actually make those judgments with the benefit of hindsight, and so that is compliant with IFRS.
So that means we are just allocating the whole asset to the most recent stripping campaign, and not allocating it to other strip campaigns where we may have incurred the cost that we have in the book. Okay, then I only have one question. Obviously that will have a large impact on the most, you know, the two or three future periods when you amortize this asset over the most recent stripping campaign. So I was asking, shouldn't we give also the option to retrospectively apply if the company is in a position to do it?
Well,
we require prospective application. It's a relief, I understand that, but do we have to impose a must here and say you have to prospectively apply?
Well, my view is that it is a must, because giving a choice doesn't aid any comparability at all. But I also believe that one of the judgments about not making estimates with the benefit of hindsight is something that precludes us from requiring retrospective application. As to whether the impact will be greatest in the next two periods or not, looking at the array of different types of mines and the pattern and the consequences that come out of the life of mine stripping ratio calculation, it may be that there is very little of an asset in there because of the way the pattern in which the expenses have been incurred and the way in which the ore is distributed. So it's a combination of incurrence of the expense and the distribution of the ore that's going to determine, in fact, whether your asset is large or small. So there's no way of knowing that if there is an asset on the balance sheet, that using this prospective approach would result in a higher or lower cost as compared to what it would have been on a fully retrospective approach. But I think that's why we're proposing one approach. Label it clearly, and then get it out of the system as quickly as possible. Laurence?
You seem to, Guido, struck me that when IFRIC 12 was issued, there are some transitions that say normally it's retrospective application, except that if it is impracticable to do retrospective application, then there are the reliefs. So I kind of have some sympathy to what Guido has expressed, that he's, yes, we want to provide relief for those where it's very difficult, but why prohibiting retrospective application if some can do it?
Well, in that case, are you suggesting we require retrospective application unless it's impracticable?
If we
try, could you write a paper to explain to us how we would do this retrospectively? Sometimes, I know it sounds the right thing to do, and that's what IFRS generally tells us, that retrospective is better. It's the preferred approach. But to recalculate, you have to recalculate the allocation of the amortization of this asset from the beginning of the life of the mine. Now, if you believe that that's something that people should do and that it would be useful information that would assist investors in making decisions about it,
I think we should ask a question on this.
What sort of a question would you like us to ask?
What do people prefer? If we go with the staff proposal, or all the alternatives such as it is written in IFRIC 12?
Okay.
We can propose
this. I'll put you down as a no. Okay. So, the majority of us agree with you, Lucy.
Okay, good.
Lucy, is there anything else you want to ask us about?
I'm just wondering, are there any other specific issues in the draft interpretation 2B that anyone wants to raise at this meeting, given that we will not have another one to discuss it, apart from the bits that we brought up in paper 2A?
A fairly small matter, but in paragraph 21, the draft talks about extraction of the ore ceases because no further economic benefits are expected. Then remaining balance should be considered for derecognition, which suggests maybe it wouldn't be derecognized. But given the lead-in, I was trying to figure out how that could be the case. The setup seemed to be one in which you would have to derecognize because it would be entirely impaired.
Would you be happy if we deleted paragraph 21?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I would.
Okay. Sir or Philippe?
Very quickly, probably discussed it in a past meeting and missed that part, but in paragraph 11, where they classify as tangible or intangible, I just have difficulties to think of a stripping campaign on an intangible, or is it because it's a leased asset? And then it would be a stripping on the leased asset, and because the asset is intangible, is that the case? You think
we decided that the stripping campaign was an enhancement of an existing asset.
Right, that's fine.
In many cases, the existing asset is going to be a tangible asset because it's the infrastructure to access whatever's been included. In some cases, it might only be a mineral right. That you've acquired, and the stripping campaign is therefore enhancing the value of that right.
So it's kind of a free situation.
Yeah. Ruth?
Just a couple of other points. I agree with Scott's comment on 21. I would rather we kept 21, but we just scrapped considered for derecognition and put in derecognized. But I have a concern about the leading in Appendix A, so it's paragraph AG1. On Appendix A, and that lead-in talks about para 18 and para 19, which is the depreciation and amortization paragraphs of the interpretation, And I'm really worried about that, because that then, to me, will create confusion in the minds of people reading this, that we're only talking about amortization here, which we're not. We're talking about allocating the asset in the first place. So I just ask you to have another look at that in terms of what reference, what paragraphs you want to refer to. I suggest it's probably paragraph 12. But I think that would just create some confusion. And the other recommendation I had throughout, for the wording throughout, is we keep using the word capitalised, and I thought we should probably use the phrase recognising the costs of an asset, just to be consistent with other IFRS literature.
Okay. Joanna?
Just a couple of comments to consider. The paragraph 21 around the derecognition, and it links this paragraph 20 as well, just that the whole thing about impairment, because effectively we're talking about impairment there, and whether we simply want to refer to the impairment standard, whether we are just too detailed here and specific, because it's implying that this thing is its own CGU, etc., etc. So I would be tempted in 20 and 21 simply to refer to impairment standards. Obviously, don't quite know whether it's intangible or whatever, but simply say it has to be impaired as per required. And likewise, in 15 and 16, a similar thing, we talk, which is the detailed description that we've got as to what constitutes the costs. And I'm just wondering again whether we are too specific to say what constitutes the cost for this particular asset. And again, just say that be much more principle based around the cost rather than trying to be specific as to what we've got in there.
John, do you, when you say we want it to be principle based, but should we make any reference to, for example, the costs that would normally be included in IS2 in inventory as being the types of costs that are included in those costs that would be included in the stripping campaign, because this focus is all on production phase stripping?
And I guess the question is, I mean, we're saying that it could be part of a fixed asset or an intangible or inventory, if you like, depending on what it is. And it's really, well, what are the costs that could be included in any of those?
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that, and I know we did talk about it before, and that's perhaps why we did get specific, because we weren't quite sure. But I do wonder whether we're being... and I probably would. I mean, if you said choose, I would probably say the sort of cost that you'd include in under two, to be honest.
Okay. Luca?
I agree with Scott and the other comments on paragraph 21, but I have a different feeling from Joanna. When I read this, I have the feeling that we are speaking about a sort of abandonment of the business, so not an impairment with the opportunity to have a reversal of the impairment. It's a little bit confusing if we are speaking about impairment with the option to have in the next future a reversal, or we are saying, no, if the oil is dry or you want to abandon that activities because it's not more profitable for you, then all what you have in your debit side has to go to the profit and loss account. I think that it's a matter of wording here, but I think that should be clarified. Speaking about the EIF impairment, I would like to include in the reference the EIF 36, because we speak about 16, 38, 1, but not impairment. I would like to draw the attention of the constituents when we will go around for the consultation on paragraph 18. It's clear that we are looking at a unit of production that is strictly linked with the amount of reserves that are specific to the part of the activities. I think that this is very relevant in the framework of this interpretation, and I would like to to have a compost on this. I come from another, from an oil and gas perspective, it's quite impossible to do this because it's difficult to
I thought in oil and gas you talk about approved developed reserves.
Yes. And the last, but it's only a problem of wording, and it will be according to the revision that we will make. When we start speaking about what shall the assets be initially recognized, so the caption before paragraph 13 and following, we speak about the assets, but all the paragraph starts with the stripping campaign. So if you are looking at the assets linked with stripping campaign, probably we could better specify and not speak about assets in general.
Okay, thanks for that. Andrew?
Well, I agree with Joanna that I think it would be better just to refer to the impairment standard, because I'm not really, to be honest, I'm not sure how you apply the concept of derecognition in these circumstances, so I found that confusing. The other thing about impairment is that if I read paragraph 20, it implies that we should look at impairment on the stripping campaign component, and we have already said that this is a component of another asset, and I don't know whether we're introducing some kind of new concept here, because I thought the impairment standard was all around impairment of the asset rather than of components of the asset. So, you know, I think we need probably to think about that as to whether we're unconsciously raising a new concept of impairment of components. And then just my last point was, paragraph 19 of the draft interpretation, we say that we would expect the life of a stripping campaign normally to differ from the life of the mine. I think this is just drafting. We then go on to say that in BC 17, the committee would not envisage that the stripping campaign would last the entire duration of the mine. And then in BC 20, we say the stripping campaign component will always be depreciated over a lesser period in the life of the mine. So, you know, there's some inconsistent language there, which I think, I assume what we really mean is what we say in paragraph 19 of the interpretation.
But are you suggesting that we strengthen that with some of the comments we've made in the basis for conclusions?
Not really.
Normally is not a word that normally stays in standards that we issue.
Well, based on my understanding, I don't think we can mandate that the life of a stripping campaign will always be less than the life of a mine. So I think that would be dangerous and over the top. So.
Serious question, though, Andrew, to reflect on is that if you have... This only deals with production stripping. So if you've already incurred costs in development for pre-stripping, so the mine is now in production, the only way in which what you're saying could actually work is having immediately started production, you immediately embark on a pushback or stripping campaign, because otherwise the life of the mine, if there is some activity that has taken place earlier, the life of the mine is always going to be longer than the period over which the stripping campaign will benefit from it. I think it would be unusual to have a developed mine that immediately has a pushback. I think I would argue that is actually, it's a continuation that is taking place of the original development work, or physically the stripping that's taking place is routine stripping.
Well, maybe we've covered this in the outreach, I don't know, but... I don't know whether there might be a case where you've got a very simple mine and the life of the mine and the stripping campaign and one of the same thing. Or alternatively, I'll come back to the comment I made earlier that I understand that some stripping campaigns are actually not done to access a specific piece of the ore, but are done to develop the entire mine. So, in which case, that seems legitimate to do so.
Okay, get the message. John?
A couple of comments. The paragraph 15, we say that only costs directly incurred to perform will be capitalized. I was wondering if we were creating different rules from what is existing And I don't remember that if we discussed that or not, but for instance, indirect costs usually are capitalizable to intangible, and I think this could be read as indirect costs not being allowable. And I don't think that's what we mean, but that's the word.
The suggestion that some others have made is, in fact, that we link this into the costs in 1638.
Yeah, I would prefer the Joanna's approach to link that. My other comments is, in paragraph 11, when we say, I know we've said that all throughout, but when we say that it's part of an existing asset, if it's part of an existing asset, it is the existing asset. So, and at the same time, we say there were specific rules for amortization of that asset. I wonder if part of is the, should be, we should modify that to talk about related to an existing asset or something like that. Because, I was thinking if it's part of, it's comprised within that asset. So how do we say it's part of an asset, but then we kind of treat that as not part of the existing asset. So just the wording that maybe if we use it's related to an existing asset, we would still link with the nature of the asset, but still treat that as a separate asset.
Yeah, the important thing in here was to bridge the gap between 16 and 38. 16 allows for components of the asset, whereas 38, the way it's written at the moment, doesn't recognize a component of an intangible. And because we weren't being specific in saying that the consequence of the stripping campaign, the asset created by the stripping campaign, is always a tangible asset, so it's an enhancement of whatever is there before, we need to use the terminology in here, component, so that people can see that this is not flying in the face of 38, but it's creating a requirement for an intangible asset that is accounted for in the same way as IS 16, as property, plant and equipment. But I think we got the points in there. Sarah?
You know what, I think you can address the concrete problem and solve the grammar issue in paragraph 11 as well by just after Flip says, to the nature of the existing asset, then after that point say, to which it relates. So delete that it is a part of, which is not great grammar. So then you address John's issue and solve the grammar problem, and you get that related in.
Laurence?
2 points. The first one is, as we are giving, introducing transitional provisions that apply prospectively, what about first-time adopters? Because as soon as you have prospective application, you need to think of first-time adopters to give them the same type of relief.
No, I think we should be harsh.
Second point.
Sorry, Lucy, have you spoken to the first-time adoption team to get their views on what we should be doing here?
I'm also the first-time adoption team.
I guess that.
I'll give it some thought. Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
Second point is paragraph 17 that says after initial recognition, the stripping campaign component shall be carried at its cost less amortized depreciation and amortization. What about a case where the component is added to a PP&E and this PP&E is carried at revalued amount? Usually
that is just a hypothetical question.
I'm asking.
This is an industry that bleats and complains bitterly that it cannot determine, even on first-time adoption, the fair value of its assets. To suggest that it might actually be on a revaluation approach is just beyond my comprehension, Laurence.
I'm just pointing the fact that...
Not the fact. Do you know of any mining companies that are engaged in surface mining activities that have adopted the revaluation approach?
Effectively not.
No. Right. Okay, so can we go on to the next point?
Okay. 16, paragraph 16, some ancillary activities may be incurred in connection with preparing the mine for production, but are not necessary for the stripping campaign. For me, it seems that if you need to build a road to do the stripping campaign, it is necessary for the stripping campaign. So therefore, I think perhaps the argument is to say that if you can identify if you can have separately identifiable assets, you recognize them separately. But I wouldn't use the wording to say it's not necessary for the stripping campaign to take place.
Right. I think the illustration here was meant to be something is taking place at the same time and in the same area as the stripping campaign. And I don't think Lucy had intended that it was developing a road in order to gain access to the stripping campaign. It could be for some ancillary reason. But sometimes too much information is confusing. So, Lucy, you might think of deleting that as well.
Deleting what? The road bit. Okay.
Yeah. Shall we?
I think the message which is delivered, then Andrew mentioned it before, I think, the message which is delivered in paragraph 8 and 9 are about the same. Where the benefit does not meet the definition of an asset, the related stripping cost shall be included in as operating costs in the current reporting period, which is said in paragraph 8. And it's about the same argument, in my view, which is delivered in paragraph 9. So, I mean, you can suppress 8 in my view.
Yeah, I think we need to make some amendments following the discussion about the definition of a stripping campaign itself. All right, we're going to bring back tomorrow or for tomorrow's discussion the definition itself. I think.
Yes, we'll do that. We'll bring that back tomorrow, and I hope we'll get agreement on that. We will then circulate to you the revised draft interpretation reflecting the various comments that we've received so that we can get any sort of final comments for you. We'd then take that to the board, well, send it to the board members for their negative clearance and then publish it for public comment following that. So we'd hope to be able to publish it before the end of August as a draft interpretation.
All right, so tomorrow morning when we have a look at the stripping campaign definition, I think, then I will ask if anybody objects to the publication of the draft, so it gives you time to reflect on some of the changes that we're making now, so that actually Lucy can perhaps just identify the key areas where there will be, not changes, I hope, to the principles, but improving the clarity of the language and the interpretation tomorrow morning, and we'll go through that then. Okay. Thank you very much, Lucy.
Thank you.
And we are now going to move into